Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's foreign minister says it is possible to achieve a final agreement in the sanctions removal talks in Doha if the U.S. and its European allies act realistically. Iran says Israel is the number one enemy of Muslims and the Muslim world, adding that Zionists only create crisis wherever they go. Also, Britain's criminal lawyers stage a walkout over low wages and insufficient government funding amid the country's dire economic crisis and soaring cost of living. It's good to have you with us. Iran's top negotiator will set off for the Qatar capital on Tuesday to hold indirect talks with the U.S. on the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. That's according to the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman. Nasser Kanani says the trip is made within the framework of agreements reached during the recent visit to Tehran by the JCPOA Joint Commission Coordinator Joseph Borrell. Iran says it was informed by Borrell that the U.S. has agreed to fulfill all its obligations under the JCPOA and ensure Iran's economic benefits. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, also says the new round of talks could yield a final agreement if the U.S. and the three EU parties to the deal adopt a realistic approach. The 2015 deal was left in tatters after the former U.S. administration unilaterally abandoned it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Talks to revive the JCPOA began in the Austrian capital in April last year between Iran and the remaining signatories to the accord. The U.S. indirectly participated in the Vienna talks. After several rounds, the talks were stalled in March this year over what Iran called the U.S. failure to make the necessary decisions. Political analyst Sayed Mohsen Abbas says the EU never really abided by the JCPOA, but it now badly needs to revive the pact due to the Ukraine war and the ongoing energy crisis. Have a listen.
The fact is that Europe, rather belatedly, are now running around with Borrell trying to up the ante in terms of a diplomatic solution to this whole mess that's known as the JCPOA. They didn't make much of an effort during that time when, as you mentioned, the INSTEX system or mechanism was meant to kick in to try and help Iran at least, find some sense of hope in the JCPOA. Europeans have never actually abided by it, and the Americans actually walked out of it. Europe now needs to revive the Iranian nuclear agreement more than ever. The need is more greater for these guys, basically. Neither Iran nor the US actually has a workable plan to manage the fallout from the deal if it collapses, if they were to do it. But the Europeans themselves, of course, with the war in Ukraine kicking off, are the prime, chaps being hit by all of the oil and other, problems, the energy problems that are arising and the food problems that are going to arise, and inflation and the possible collapse of a lot of their kind of economies.
Iran's foreign minister says Israel is the arch enemy of Muslims and the Muslim world, warning that Zionists create instability and crisis wherever they go. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments during a joint press conference with his Turkish counterpart Mevlut Çavuşoğlu in Ankara. The top Iranian diplomat praised Turkey's unwavering support for Palestine and the liberation of Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. However, Amir Abdullahian said he has relayed Iran's sensitivity and considerations regarding Israel's moves to the Turkish side. While on a visit to Ankara last week, the regime's foreign minister claimed that Iran was planning anti-Israeli attacks in Turkey. Tehran dismissed the allegations as baseless and ridiculous, and part of a plot to destroy relations between the two Muslim countries. Aid agencies in Afghanistan say survivors of the last week earthquake are in urgent need of cash to rebuild their lives. The 6.1 magnitude quake hit the eastern parts of Afghanistan, killing more than 1,000 people. The survivors are facing food and clean water shortages too. Our Kabul correspondent has the details.
New problems are emerging as expected by the experts. Lack of clean water and food brought about the risk of disease and cholera is spreading. Many are suffering from diarrhea. Women and girls are at higher risks due to lack of access to health and hygiene supplies. People, especially people in those areas, say they expected more countries to contribute humanitarian aids. Sarajuddin Haqqani, Minister of Interior Affairs of Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, mentioned that many countries cannot send aids to Afghanistan because of U.S. sanctions. Abdul Kahar Balfi, spokesman of Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the IEA, also said liberation of the assets of Central Bank of Afghanistan is vital for the people. The matter of assets of Afghanistan is also mentioned by Hua Chuning, spokesman of Ministry of Foreign Affairs of China. Mr. Chuning requested the liberation of the assets of Afghanistan and mentioned that 1,800 homes are destroyed due to this earthquake.
In the UK, strikes over low wages have spread to the legal profession. British criminal lawyers have staged a walkout in London to protest against government funding and dwindling earnings. According to the Criminal Bar Association, barristers voted for industrial action earlier this month. More than 80% of its members backed walkouts. On Monday, several hundred barristers gathered outside the Central Criminal Court. They have refused to take on new cases or cover cases for colleagues which have overrun. Protesting lawmakers say their real earnings have dropped around 30% since 2006. They also say many junior barristers have left their jobs due to low income. The Criminal Bar Association has urged the government to sit down with barristers for negotiation.
This must come to an end, and it will, if this government is prepared to sit down with us and negotiate. We cannot continue to work like this.
The CBA also said the walkout is aimed at preventing the collapse of the criminal justice system, which is already mired in crisis. It said the justice system has long been suffering from a shortage of lawyers. The British government has reacted to the strike, saying the walkouts are regrettable. The lawyers' strike comes hot on the heels of an industrial action by some 40,000 British railway workers. The explosion of a chlorine gas tank in Jordan has left at least 12 people dead as a result of poisonous gas release. According to Jordanian officials, over 250 people have been also injured in the incident. The explosion took place in the Red Sea port of Agaba. Footage shows a tank filled with 25 tons of chlorine gas, which was being transported to Djibouti, falling from a crane and slamming into the deck of a ship. The incident led to the release of poisonous yellow fumes. Officials evacuated nearby areas following the gas leak. Agaba grain silos halted work, but maritime traffic continues. Residents of Agaba have been told to stay in their homes and shut all windows to avoid exposure to dangerous chemical substances. The Jordanian government has ordered an investigation into the incident. An outcry is growing over the death of around two dozen African migrants trying to cross from Morocco into Spain. The African Union is the latest to join the chorus of condemnations.
I express my deep shock and concern at the violent and degrading treatment of African migrants attempting to cross an international border from Morocco into Spain, with the ensuing violence leading to the deaths of at least 23 people and injuries to many more.
AU Commission Chief Mohamed also called for an immediate investigation into the matter. He said using excessive force against migrants is a violation of international law. About 2,000 migrants tried to break through a border fence between Morocco and the Spanish enclave of Melilla on Friday. Morocco says at least 23 migrants died and 140 police officers were wounded in the violence. The Spanish PM blamed what he described as mafia people, traffickers, for the fatal incident. Pedro Sanchez described it as an attack on Spain's territorial integrity. Hundreds of protesters rallied in Madrid on Sunday to condemn the deaths. The demonstrators slammed police violence and demanded safe routes for migrants. Sri Lanka announces a 2-week halt to all fuel sales except for essential services as the crisis-hit country faces acute shortages. The government announced that only essential services such as the health sector will operate from Monday midnight until July 10th. Cabinet of Ministers said that all schools will be shut and everyone is urged to work from home during this time. Scheduled power cuts will also rise to 3 hours from Monday. Sri Lanka is suffering from its worst economic crisis as the island nation is unable to import essential commodities. Experts say an escalation of fuel shortage could lead to a fresh wave of demonstrations. Last week, Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe said that the country's economy has collapsed after months of shortages and cannot even import oil. Moving on to the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine, which is now in its fifth month. Kiev says 16 people are killed in a new Russian missile attack on the central Ukrainian city of Kremenchuk. Local authorities say the strike hit a crowded shopping mall. Nearly 60 people were also injured. Ukraine's capital, Kiev, was also hit by Russian missiles for the first time in 3 weeks. Ukrainian authorities say the attack killed one person and wounded 6 others. A fierce battle is also raging on in the eastern Donbass region. According to media reports, Russian troops are advancing into Lysychansk, the last major city still in the hands of Ukrainian forces in the Luhansk region. Ukraine says Russia is also bombing the city. That comes just days after the Russian army took over the neighboring city of Severodonetsk after weeks of siege. The World Food Program says it is suspending humanitarian aid to Yemen. The international body says it's halting the shipments due to lack of funding and disruptions in food supplies rooted in the war in Ukraine. Abdulatif Al-Washili brings us the details from Sana'a.
After years of war and blockade on Yemen, and just as hopes were being raised that the humanitarian situation will improve thanks to the UN brokered truce, the World Food Programme has announced that it is suspending humanitarian work in the country since the beginning of June. The body says it is short on funding and that obstacles to food supply due to war in Ukraine are making things worse.
There is no doubt that the decision of the World Food Programme to suspend its activities in Yemen is catastrophic and surprising. The World Food Programme announced earlier this year that it will be cutting off on humanitarian aid for Yemen due to lack of funding. The suspension of humanitarian activities is a totally different story and has major repercussions, as Yemen is facing what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Unfortunately, the UN and its food assistance programme link humanitarian aid to political and military issues.
The program now says that the Yemen humanitarian response plan for 2022 is 74% underfunded, which means the program requires $1.5 billion in funding.
What the media reported, that the World Food Program will suspend its activities in Yemen, will lead to a humanitarian catastrophe with unimaginable consequences. We hold the United Nations fully responsible for the repercussions of halting humanitarian aid, as Yemen is in a phase of famine.
Saudi Arabia began its war on Yemen in March 2015 and has imposed a siege on the country ever since. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine, where almost 80% of the population depends on humanitarian aid to survive.
After all the hard work put into reaching the current truce and extending it, suspension of humanitarian aid could also undermine the political process. The United Nations should now double its efforts and change its strategies to help Yemenis in dire need of aid. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
An official Iranian delegation representing the media sector in Iran has paid a 2-day visit to Syria, headed by Chief of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, Peyman Jebedi. Our correspondent in Damascus has the details in this report.
An official Iranian delegation headed by Chief of the IRIB, Peyman Jibili, arrived in Damascus and met with Syria's Prime Minister Hossein Arnous, who called for expansion of ties with Iranian media outlets for unmasking false media campaigns that some countries launched to mislead the public opinion on the truth of events in West Asia. Jibili, who also had a separate meeting with Minister of Information Boutros Halaq, said economic pressure on Syria is a result of Syria's triumph on terror and the defeat of enemies, stressing the importance of strong cooperation in confronting the media war against the two states.
Our meetings with Syrian officials will open a new and wide page in cultural and media cooperation. Due to Syria's resistance and its allies, the war on Syria failed in its objectives. We should document this victory in the mind of the Arab and world public opinion, and this requires a high level of cooperation with Syria in the media sector. This is what we agreed on today.
Coordination among media sectors is highly important. We as a resistance alliance are facing media empires which no state can face alone. We should face pressures, sanctions, and false campaigns. So we all should combine efforts in Iran, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Palestine.
Meanwhile, the delegation participated in a seminar held in rejection of normalization of relations with Israel. Jibili said the reason behind pressures on the peoples of the region is the failure of enemies' conspiracies, asserting there is no future for normalization with Israel.
The normalization of relations with Israel that we witnessed recently by some states in the region is almost coming to an end because the people do not accept it. Normalization has no future because it is against the principles of humanity. Normalization with the killer of children and journalists is not logical. We will defeat the enemy in the media just like we fought the conspiracies, and that is only if we are united.
The delegation is scheduled to hold more meetings on Tuesday and sign agreements with Syrian media outlets. The visit aims to further boost cooperation between the media sectors of both countries to reach the level of strategic relations between Syria and Iran and strongly counter the media war waged against member countries of the Resistance Alliance. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
And that report brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I am now at the airport and I'm late as always. I hope that the gate is still open and I arrive on time.
Oh, thank you, God. The flight's gate is still open. Oh, my today's destination is Sistan and Baluchistan province. I'm going to visit one of the extraordinary archaeological sites of Iran. Shahr Sukhte, literally, the burnt city. Shahr Sukhte is the remains of an ancient city in Iran. This city was built on the alluvium of the estuary of the Hirmand River to Lake Hamun. Shahr Sukhte is located 120 kilometers south of the city of Zabul. This large city was built in Bronze Era, and Iranians used to live in this city almost 6,000 years ago. The total area of the city is 280 hectares and is divided into residential, central, and industrial areas, as well as monuments and cemetery. These areas are situated in the form of successive hills. The ancient area of Shahr Sukhte is about 18 meters higher than the land surrounding it. Shahr Sukhte used to be an advanced city at its time. The remains of Shahr Sukhte shows that this city had a well-managed system for water supply and sewage. This unique heritage was registered by the UNESCO World Heritage List in 2014. I am now near Shahr Sukhte site. Here we have the scenery of desert, and there is no tree here except tamarisk trees. Though 5,000 years BC, this region had a diverse flora. This region used to have abundant weeping willow, maple, and white poplar trees. In order to see the remains of Shahr Sukhte, I have to go up this hill. I am now in the area of the cemetery. There are triangular forms here. I think they're made of adobe. Archaeologists have found traces of clod in these graves. These fabrics were used either for wrapping the dead or in the form of underlays and covers for the dead. In these graves, many pottery objects have been discovered. One of these well-known pottery artifacts is a pottery vessel with a drawing of a goat and a tree. Giving the vessel a spin, one would see a goat leaping to snatch leaves from a tree. This can be recognized as the first animation movie in the world. I am now standing beside the grave number 6705. In this grave, the skeleton of a robust woman with her left eye being artificial was found. On this artificial eyeball, the eye's capillaries are made with thin gold wires. This artificial eye is one of the great wonders of the world. You might might have asked yourself why this city is called the Burnt City. Researchers say Shahr-e Sukhte used to be an industry which had a lot of furnaces. Therefore, ash was found due to the activity of industrial furnaces around the city. And when archaeologists first spotted ash in this city, they came to the idea to call this city Shahr-e Sukhte, literally the burnt city. Actually, the real name of this city is not known yet. The wonders of Shahr-e Sukhte are a lot, and researchers are still studying this ancient city. One of the most significant conclusions derived from these findings is that the inhabitants of Shahr-e Sukhte had been really civilized and peace-seeking people. Well, our beautiful Iran is, of course, full of wonders and beauties. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends. And today we present you a thought-provoking saying from Imam Muhammad Taqi, peace upon him, the 9th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He who listens to the one who calls is actually serving him. If the caller was God's representative, he is then serving God. If the caller was the Satan's representative, he is then serving the Satan.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, what is faith? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's topic, we want to cover a very important point, and that is the point of faith, or al-Iman. What is faith in its essence? Well, no doubt, every one of us know that we have different ideas. We have knowledge about many things, but we don't have that belief and that faith in it. What does that mean? It means that the knowledge has levels in our soul. It has levels in ourselves. There are instances of knowledge where we know something, and with the passage of time, it just goes out of our mind and we don't have any kind of connection and attention to that thing. This type of knowledge is something we cannot call it faith or belief. But another things we know that when we know them, the ideas, which not just that we have a knowledge of them, but they become rooted in our self. They become ingrained in our very essence. They become part of us. We cannot deny them. We cannot minus them from our thought. They are part of us. They are part of our intellectual life. Such an idea and such a thought, which becomes ingrained and rooted in your personality, is called belief, is called the faith. That's what becomes rooted and ingrained in your thought and in yourself. Welcome back. This is A to Z. We were talking about faith. Well, in the last segment, we talked about the reality of the faith. It is the kind of idea or a view which becomes ingrained and rooted in our personality. So you cannot detach it from yourself easily. It becomes rooted in you. So some of the scholars says that there are two type of connections in the faith. First is the connection which is between the subject and its predicate, the subject and the judgment. That connection is the first point in the faith. And second is the connection between the central subject of that statement and your soul, yourself. These together make the faith. If there is an idea, if there is a view which is rooted and connected to your soul, it is called the faith. Now, is there any hint and indication in Islam about this? Yes. In Quran, Allah says, قَالَتِ الْأَعْرَابُ آمَنَّا قُلْ لَمْ تُؤْمِنُوا وَلَكِنْ قُولُوا أَسْلَمْنَا وَلَمَّا يَدْخُلُ الْإِيمَانُ فِي قُلُوبِكُمْ. When there were people in the life of holy prophets, they used to say that we have faith in Islam. We have faith. We believed in Islam. Quran says that tell them, O holy prophet, tell them, لَمَّا يَدْخُلِ الْإِيمَانُ فِي قُلُوبِكُمْ. Tell them, you should say that we have submission to Islam. We have the submission towards Allah. But don't say that we have iman and faith. Because وَلَمَّا يَدْخُلِ الْإِيمَانُ فِي قُلُوبِكُمْ. Because the faith and the reality of the belief has not reached your hearts. So, what is faith? It is something which is rooted in our heart, which you cannot forget about easily. So, faith is something rooted deep in your heart. And that is why we need to make faith rooted in our heart. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala help us to have real belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with delight.
Staff at the National Zoo of Cuba in the capital city of Havana are celebrating a new arrival of a rare baby white rhinoceros. The little calf, named Al, quickly became popular among other animals in the park after he was born. He is part of a conservation program that will add to a gene bank for future breeding. Al is the second white rhinoceros to be born in captivity in 18 years. The park is home to 8 white rhinos and 4 black ones. Zoo staff say the park has one of the largest exhibits of this mammal among zoos in Latin America. White rhinos are endangered species, and their population has dwindled due to illegal poaching and environmental destruction.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in Southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, 5 deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past 6 decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtanaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Youssef Jalali from Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
Catching fish makes you forget even the most complex problems, but think the moment you catch the strangest one. Well, a Cambodian fisherman has caught what researchers say is the world's biggest freshwater fish ever recorded. The giant fish, which weighs around 300 kilograms and 4 meters long, was caught last week from the Mekong River. The female stingray was released back into water after being electronically tag to allow scientists to monitor her movement and behavior. The fish was named a Barami, meaning full moon in the Khmer language. An American fish biologist, Dana Lee, says the data collected from Barami can help protect the species and its habitat.
We got a call this morning at breakfast that they had caught a giant stingray here at Coprea. So we dropped everything. People came up from Phnom Penh, and we're here now just at sunset. Just tagged the giant, 330-kilogram giant stingray here in the Mekong River, and released it here right at sunset.
The stingray dethrones the former record holder, a 290-kilogram catfish found in northern Thailand in 2005. More than 1,000 species live in the Mekong River. The famous waterway originates in China and twists south through parts of Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Scientists have warned that plastic waste and dam threaten wildlife even in the deepest stretches of the Mekong. Geologists are rejoicing over a new discovery. A 290-million-old fossil forest has accidentally been found in southern Brazil. A team of geologists had been sent to the state of Paraná to investigate the rocks there. To their surprise, they were able to find over 160 logs of lycophytes, an extinct variety of the vascular plant subgroup. It's quite rare occurrence that a large number of fossils of the plant were found preserved in upright position for such a long time. The forest itself was discovered in 2018 when a street was being constructed over there. So far, only two other similar collections have been found in smaller forest areas of Brazil and Argentina.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
June 21st marks the International Day of Yoga. On this day, people, especially Hindus around the world, gather in open spaces to perform this ancient physical exercise, raising awareness of its benefits on the human body and mind. Yoga is believed to have originated in India thousands of years ago and is mentioned in ancient Hindu mythological books. The word yoga derives from Sanskrit and means to join or unite, symbolizing the union of body and consciousness. In India, the day is celebrated with a different theme each year, with this year's theme being Yoga for Humanity. Mass yoga events took place around India, especially in and around iconic sites such as the Taj Mahal. Other countries such as Vietnam and Thailand also celebrated Yoga Day with hundreds performing it in open spaces. Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community. Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. One of the employees describes how they turned barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, But since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most.
People in Poland have rolled out flower carpets for the Feast of Corpus Christi held in the central village of Spiszemierz. Families usually arrange colorful and symbolic carpets for the procession on the road section in front of their homes. They use flowers picked from the surrounding fields or their own gardens. They also use soil, sand, and fresh cut grass. The procession begins from the church and roams the streets of the village. The flower carpets have been rolled out annually since the tradition started 200 years ago, except for once when a storm broke out.
This tradition is 200 years old, and according to what the village elders say, it has only happened once that there was no carpet of flowers for the procession, because a storm broke out and swept everything away in the afternoon.
Families begin collecting the flowers a few days before the feast and arrange it on the celebration day. Besides its religious aspect, the event is also meant to express appreciation for nature. The practice has been passed from generation to generation ever since it began. The tradition was registered at UNESCO's cultural heritage list last year.
Artists have turned a historic village in the Tunisian island of Djerba into a vibrant open-air art museum. The organizer of the project says he has always had a clear vision for the gallery.
The goal of this project is to create a new way of displaying urban art, to create a museum, a real museum, which labels for the works with a certain lighting, certain works and staging. Also to create a dynamic to give this museum to the residents so that they could appropriate it and it almost becomes their business.
The project is called Djerbehud and it's located in a town of Eriyadh. Since 2014, about 150 artists from 35 different nations have gathered there to produce eye-catching street art. Tourists say they enjoy visiting the gallery because they can see something new every time they come round. Residents of the town are also content with the vibrant looks of their streets, saying the artwork give a little movement to their everyday lives.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Assange persecution is the greatest threat to Western press freedoms in years. It is also a shining monument to the fraud of American and British self-depictions, says Glenn Greenwald, author, in an article published under the heading The UK's decision to extradite Assange shows why the US-UK's freedom lectures are a farce. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. The recent UK Home Secretary's decision, characteristically subservient and obedient of the British when it comes to the demands of the US, does not mean that Assange's presence on US soil is imminent. Under British law, Assange has the right to pursue a series of appeals contesting the Home Secretary's decision and will likely do so. Given that the British judiciary has more or less announced in advance their determination to follow the orders of their American masters, it is difficult to see how these further proceedings will have any effect other than to delay the inevitable. But putting oneself in Assange's position, it is easy to see why he is so eager to avoid extradition to the US for as long as possible. The Espionage Act of 1917 is a nasty and repressive piece of legislation. It was designed by Woodrow Wilson and his band of authoritarian progressives to criminalize dissent against Wilson's decision to involve the US in the First World War. It was used primarily to imprison anti-war leftists such as Eugene Debs, as well as anti-war religious leaders such as Joseph Franklin Rutherford, for the crime of publishing a book condemning Wilson's foreign policy. One of the most insidious despotic innovations of the Obama administration was to repurpose and revitalize the Wilson-era Espionage Act as an all-purpose weapon to punish whistleblowers who denounced Obama's policies. The Obama Justice Department under Attorney General Eric Holder prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act of 1917 than all previous administrations combined. In fact, three times as many as all prior presidents combined. One whistleblower charged by Obama officials under that law is NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, who in 2013 revealed mass domestic spying of precisely the kind that Obama's Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, now of CNN, falsely denied conducting when testifying to the Senate, which led to legislative curbs enacted by the U.S. Congress and which courts have ruled unconstitutional and illegal. What makes this law so insidious is that, by design, it is almost impossible for the government to lose. As detailed in a Washington Post op-ed when the indictment was first revealed, arguing why it poses the greatest threat to press freedoms in the West in years, this 1917 law is written as a strict liability statute, meaning that the defendant is not only guilty as soon as there is proof that they disclosed classified information without authorization, but they are also barred from raising a justification defense, meaning they cannot argue to the jury of their peers that it was not only permissible but morally necessary to disclose that information because of the serious wrongdoing and criminality it revealed on the part of the nation's most powerful political officials. That 1917 law, in other words, is written to offer only show trials but not fair trials. No person in their right mind would willingly submit to prosecution and life imprisonment in the harshest American penitentiaries under an indictment brought under this fundamentally corrupted law. Whatever else one might think of Assange, there is simply no question that he is one of the most consequential, pioneering, and accomplished journalists of his time. One could easily make the case that he occupies the top spot by himself. And that, of course, is precisely why he is in prison, because just like free speech, free press guarantees in the US and UK exist only on a piece of parchment and in theory. Citizens are free to do journalism as long as it does not disturb or anger or impede real power centers. Employees of the Washington Post and CNN are free to say what they want as long as what they are saying is approved and directed by the CIA, or the content of their reporting advances the interest of the Pentagon's sprawling war machine. Real journalists often face threats of prosecution, imprisonment, or even murder, and sometimes even mean tweets. Much of the American corporate media class has ignored Assange's persecution or even cheered it precisely because he shames them, serving as a vivid mirror to show them what real journalism is and how they are completely bereft of it. And the American and British governments have successfully exploited the petty jealousies and insecurities of their failed, vapid, and pointless media servants to get away with imposing the single greatest threat to press freedom in the West without much protest at all. Free speech and press freedoms do not exist in reality in the US or in the UK. They are merely rhetorical instruments to propagandize their domestic population and justify and ennoble the various wars and other forms of subversion they constantly wage in other countries in the name of upholding values they themselves do not support. The Julian Assange persecution is a great personal tragedy, a political travesty, and a grave danger to basic civic freedoms. But it is also a bright and enduring monument to the fraud and deceit that lies at the heart of these two governments' depictions of who and what they are.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, people, organizations and the region as a whole. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how, with rising communal tensions in India, the use of bulldozers by the government has caused widespread fear among the Muslim population of the country. And we will also head over to Bangladesh to see if the country is due to become the next Sri Lanka, as the country faces a serious trade deficit amid global inflation and supply chain problems.
The person who invented the bulldozer perhaps only intended it to be a heavy machine used in construction work.
However, in India, houses, shops, and small businesses belonging to Muslim protesters are now being demolished. Thus, bulldozers are not just seen as heavy machinery anymore. They are a symbol of power for Hindu nationalist politicians and a symbol of oppression and fear for the Muslims. After the protests once again